In the first hour today, we'll be talking about marriage. And our guest for the program is Judith Yorst. She is a best-selling author of books including Suddenly 60, Forever 50, Necessary Losses, and other works. She is a published poet. She has several collections of poetry out. She's also the author of 16 children's books, including one very popular title, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. We'll be talking this morning about some of the ideas that you will find in her recent book, which is titled Grown Up Marriage. It's now published in paperback, published by the Free Press. And I'd just like to read you the first paragraph from her introduction to start us out. She writes this: "Although marriage is for grown-ups, very few of us are grown up when we marry. Growing up takes time, perhaps a whole lifetime, and getting there, if we get there at all, is hard. But marriage, which can be the most vexatious of human relationships, can also be the engine of our growth. For in making some sort of peace with the disenchantments, demands, and astonishing complexities of ordinary, everyday married life, we can create, and no, this isn't a contradiction in terms, a grown-up marriage." The book, as I say, is published by Free Press. It's now in paper. She is joining us this morning by telephone. She's a graduate of Rutgers and the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute. She's received many awards for her journalism and also her psychological writings. And questions, comments as we talk are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Ms. Yorst, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Delighted to be here.
In the beginning of the book, you talk a little bit about why it is people get married, and talk first about how, at the time that you got married, how people, men and women, thought about it then, what they were looking for in marriage.
Well, and quite a contrast.
And it is quite a contrast. Why, maybe let's talk about today. Why is it you think that now people in their, you know, 20s, kids think, and what do they want to get married?
Well, they want to get married because they see it as a different and larger commitment. Over and over again, I asked a whole bunch of kids my children's age, my married children's age, why they got married. And one way or another, what they said to me was, I want to announce to the wider world that I am making this commitment. I want to proclaim in a public wedding ceremony that I'm hers and she's mine and we're going to be together forever. I want the blessings of the family and the community. And in one way or another, what they're saying to me is that it's the public aspect of marriage, something that is larger than a private commitment between two people, that makes marriage desirable, even in a day when you can have sex without marriage, when you can live together without marriage, where your mother probably won't even commit suicide if you have a baby without marriage.
I wonder to what extent, though, that part of the reason that people think about getting married is that there is a kind of expectation that people will, and that there is, you know, I appreciate the fact that some of the people you talked to really had actually put some thought into this. But I wonder how many people that decision is relatively unexamined, and they do it just because, well, that's what people do. They get married.
Well, there may be some people who don't examine it, but it seems to me among the people I've been talking to, they examine it to pieces, and they're working out their issues, and they want to be sure. And the fact that a lot of them come from broken homes, or the fact that they just look at the divorce rate, and it's 46% of first marriages end in divorce, I see people very worried about, are we doing the right thing? Is this making sense? Quite the opposite of just blindly rushing into it, sort of examining it ad nauseum, examining it in the hopes that they can absolutely predict that they have picked the right person, that they're 100% sure, and that this is going to last for the rest of their life, something we really cannot predict. I mean, one of my arguments in this book is that the person you choose, the person you marry, is to a large extent a matter of dumb luck.
I'm glad you came right out. You come right out and say that. It's something that I've thought, and maybe some other people have entertained that notion that, in fact, when you look at really successful marriages. This is not discounting the fact that work is involved in making a successful marriage, but part of it, I think that you're right. It is just absolute, plain, flat luck.
You definitely need the work, but if you're not lucky in what you're working with, the work's not going to be enough. And the less dumb luck you have, the harder you have to work on making it work.
Yeah. Something, too, that's just, I think, another remarkable truth is that until you're in it, you really don't know what you're getting into. And I think it doesn't matter how well people think they know one another, and even if people have lived together, once you get marriage, it is an entirely new ballgame. And I think people are surprised by that.
Yes, and I think it's absolutely true. And I think it has to do with the forever commitment. I mean, before you're married, you know, you're saying, she pitches a fit if I'm 20 seconds late. He's such a cheapskate. What a slob that person is. And what you're doing is you're thinking, well, I'll work around it, it's funny, I'll ignore it, or secretly in your secret heart, I'll change it. And then you get married and you realize that these irritating qualities you thought you could dismiss or reform are going to be with you for the entire rest of your life. And all of a sudden, you know, it's you're not on consignment, you've made a sale.
Do you think that, we were talking a moment ago about you're thinking that people now, particularly young people, think a lot about marriage before going into it because they recognize that the divorce rate is high and their parents might have been divorced, so they really want to get it right.
They want to be sure. I've heard this an awful lot from friends of mine who are divorced, whose kids have spent a long time dragging their feet before being able to make a commitment, even when they've found what looks to the entire rest of the community found the perfect person. And they want to nail it, and you can't nail it in advance because even if you feel you really know yourself and the other person, that's who you are right now. And you don't know what you're going to be 5, 10, 15 years from now, what life is going to do to you, what strengths and weaknesses are going to be exhibited. You can't predict that, and I think people long for more certainty than they can get. Then, even if you take a compatibility quiz, it's not going to guarantee anything.
Do you think that people, young people particularly, go into marriage with that idea, with the idea that it will be a lifelong commitment?
You know, I do. I do. We suspect otherwise because of the high divorce rate. We think, they're spoiled, instant gratification, and if they don't like it, get out. But I think people do go into it hoping that they're going to stay married for the rest of their lives. I don't think they understand how much hard work, patience, tolerance, compromise, disappointment, and sweat you have to put into even the very, very best of marriages. And you know, I've talked to a lot of marriage counselors who deal with people trying to save their marriage at every stage along the way, from fairly newlyweds up to people married a very long time. And most of the marriage counselors will tell you that a lot more marriages could be saved if people really, really were willing to put in this very hard work.
Do you think that if people were required to, everybody who was getting married was required to go through some sort of premarital counseling exercise, that would really help?
Well, I hate the concept of required. I mean, what it takes is an understanding of yourself to some extent, an understanding of the other person to some extent, to give yourself a decent shot at it. And, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. I'm very uncomfortable about all this talk about people getting instructed in marriage with government-supported growth. I think we have to do our own growing, and if we choose to do it through a marriage counselor, fine. I think it might clarify things for us, but I'm not too thrilled about the government getting into it.
Our guest this morning, Judith Yorst, she is a best-selling author. She's written a number of books, prose, poetry. She's written many children's books. Her most recent, which is now out in paperback, it's titled Grown Up Marriage, published by the Free Press. The subtitle of the book is What We Know, Wish We Had Known, and Still Need to Know About Being Married. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that probably everybody can, people can think back to the, whatever relationship they're in, they can think back to the early stages and can remember that consuming, giddy, goofy, lustful early stage when nothing else seemed to matter, there wasn't anything else. There was just the relationship. There was the thrill of being with the other person. And, you know, that can take your mind off a lot of other stuff.
It can take your mind off a lot of other stuff. Stars in the eyes make it hard to see.
Exactly. And then you come down to the point where normal daily life begins to intervene. And you realize that, well, you know, there are just a lot of regular stuff that needs to be done. If you have children, they need to be taken care of. And occasionally, whether it needs or not, the floor needs to be vacuumed and there's laundry and there's garbage to take out and you got to take the car for an oil change and on and on and on.
And you're discussing these things. I mean,
the most boring around, stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you're not discussing poetry or the meaning of life or the exquisite acting performance in this play we saw last night. You're discussing, you know, how many dishes do you have to have in the dishwasher before it's okay to turn the dishwasher on? This is an actual conversation people have, along with all those others on what's a comfortable room temperature, what's a safe speed on the freeway. You can't believe that you, who used to hold hands and agree on all of the major issues of the day, you're not talking about the major issues of the day. You're talking about carpools. Oil change. You're absolutely right.
So I guess then there's two things. You know, one is accommodating to the fact that a lot of life is not very interesting and fairly routine, and you got to talk about that. But then the other thing is, you know, particularly if you've been together a long time, and probably in popular culture is full of these things like, you know, how to put that spark back into your marriage. You know, how do you put that spark back into your marriage?
Well, there are two very different answers to that, at least two that I would suggest. One, what I hear from psychiatrists all the time is that in these families where you have the marriage, the children, and the two careers, the career doesn't get shortchanged and the kids don't get shortchanged. There's room to shortchange only one thing, and that's the marriage. And that's what always gets sort of the leftovers in time and attention. And people really have to make a special effort to say, we're going out once a week. We are taking care of the marriage. We are watering this garden. We are watching over it. It is too important to be, you know, put on the back burner. I talked to a woman recently who said that she and her husband once a year go somewhere and renew their vows to each other, just personally, and add new things or look over some of the old things. And that's how they keep a spark in the marriage. The other part of it, and I think this is a very important part of it too, is coming to the realization, which we really don't have when we're real young, that ordinary, everyday married life is its own version of happiness and is its own kick and is its own spark. That there might be nothing that beats sitting around on a Sunday in silence with the music playing in the background, reading the papers with somebody who knows you better than anyone else in the world, someone you know better than anyone else in the world, with the trust and the comfort and openness of two people in a companionable silence. You're not going to call that happiness when you're a young kid, but as you grow up and into your marriage, you may discover that that's a very, very big component of happiness.
We have a couple of callers. We have someone on a cell phone. We'll get them first on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just mention there are four things that my wife and I basically use to have to maintain a good relationship over the last 34 years. Actually, the first insight we had was watching a WILL TV fundraiser where they had Deborah Tannen, who talks about gender differences
in communication.
Yes, and what we realize is that a lot of the discussions, we use the word discussions, that we had, that I would be taking something she said personally and she would be taking something I said personally, was really, we were doing gender things so that we shouldn't have to take it personally. It's just like, oh, well, that's a guy thing he's doing, you know. So we learned that. The other thing which we eventually learned is that a lot of our conversations, which I don't think mundane discussions about what's going on actually are boring. I think they're extremely important because they're such an integral part of your life. But we learned that when we would get into these, again, discussions...
You're using discussions instead of the word argument, I gather.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. I got this.
Okay, we found that we were actually going through scripts. These were the things that continually bother you, you know, continually and continually. A lot of people think that you'll get used to somebody, to the idiosyncrasies, and actually, if you don't get along with them, basically, they just get more irritating. But if you do get along, then you can just say, oh, we're, and what would happen is we would start our script, and we always knew how it would end, and we just started laughing because we didn't have to bother.
Absolutely. It's great, okay. Saving grace.
Right. The third thing, and since we're now retired, and we don't have any children, so, but my wife and I were getting very close to one another and being with one another all the time, and she doesn't function at the same speed of doing things as I do. And we talked to our doctor, and I got my doctor to convince my wife that it was okay that we each drive our own car and we just meet, you know, at the coffee shop where we meet, where we sit. And that gave us such a sense of independence, because even when someone waits in the car for you, you're feeling rushed in the store because you've got someone who's waiting for you.
Yeah, you hear that toe tapping impatiently, right, in the background.
So, and so we developed that. And the last thing, which is just something I want to mention, because this has come up, and I've spoken to other people. A lot of people, of course, when they're married, sleep in the same bed. But I have found more and more people are actually, somebody is going into the living room or into another side room because their spouse snores. And it's very traumatic to come to the conclusion that you don't have to sleep with one another all the time and to set up separate, you know, either separate beds or even using different rooms, particularly if you've had children and they've moved out. That doesn't mean you've lost intimacy. What it means is you're both getting inadequate sleep.
And I'll tell you what I love about what you're saying. What I love is that you've been married 34 years, and you're still thinking about and working on your marriage. You're still looking for ways to understand yourself better and to do it better. And I think that's absolutely wonderful.
Oh, yeah, and every day, I mean, my wife just a week ago said one thing that you do when you get obnoxious is, I'm just don't respond.
Right.
And the withdrawal is actually appropriate. You have to know when to pursue something if it's important enough. But also, if the person's in the wrong frame of mind, they're not going to accept
no. And one of the great secrets of marriage is knowing when you just shut up.
Yeah, and I agree with you. The thing is, every day, every week, we're learning new things, and we're always making adjustments. Anyone who thinks it gets easier is going in with the wrong attitude to a marriage. And the best thing is to not make it get worse and work on things. And I'm concerned in today's society that people say, well, I gave it, you know, 6 months, or I gave it a year, and I'm not happy. And the idea that, first of all, you're supposed to always be happy is a mistaken idea. And,
well, you sound like a couple that really does have a grown-up marriage, and I congratulate you.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. I particularly like your comment, and it's in the book, about how, and I have thought this myself, and I have tried to put it into practice, that sometimes you just, you got to know when to shut up. There's just no two ways about it. There are times when you know, you're thinking to yourself, I want to say, and then you think, no.
No.
No, you don't. No,
no,
just
you
forget
don't.
It. Forget it. Forget it. That can go a long way to keeping peace.
It really can. You know, because we're all raised in the popular culture, communicate, express what's in your heart, say what's on your mind, let it all hang out. And sometimes that can be so useless or so bruising or so unnecessary that if you could just not do that sometimes, you could make a great difference in your marriage. Mm.
Let's talk with another caller in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I just wanted to say this is an excellent topic. I just had a couple thoughts. I wanted to say we've been married for 13 years, and one thing that we have found is that it's always best to be honest, and that is the hardest thing to do, to be really honest about how you're feeling about something, to not let things fester and just to be able to talk about it appropriately, not to bash your spouse over the head with with how you're feeling. And another thought I had is I remember reading years ago a book by Harville Hendricks in which he says that marriage, a lot of people think that marriage is a box that you climb into with somebody else. And if you're not happy, you just get out of that box and get into it again with somebody else instead of thinking that marriage is something that you create with somebody else.
Absolutely. It's an organic entity that you're always creating.
I know. I was just going to say my husband and I talk about it as like it's our second child. And you know, it's a living thing that needs care. And I don't think a lot of people really realize that you need to spend time with each other, spend time on your marriage.
I love that you mentioned that because when our last son got married, I actually wrote a sonnet which I read at the wedding ceremony, which began, "There's you and you, and then there's this third thing, which is the marriage."
Yes.
And it's a poem about the third thing that you to which you bring your love and attention and care, and for which you make certain concessions and certain sacrifices because it's going to give you so much in return.
Oh, yes. And I guess lastly, I just wanted to share, my husband's, we were tossing about ideas about what the definition of a good marriage, and I like my husband's, and he said it's a safe place for you to grow as a person, for both people to, because you're continually evolving. And so a good marriage is a safe place to do this. So, well, I'll hang up.
That's the perfect definition for grown-up marriage.
Yes, well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We are about midway through this first hour of Focus 580, and we're talking with Judith Viorst. She has published a number of books, prose and poetry. She's the author of 16 children's books. Her most recent is titled Grown Up Marriage. The subtitle is What We Know, Wish We Had Known, and Still Need to Know About Being Married. It's now out in paper. It's published by the Free Press. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. It seems to me that one of the most difficult and, again, a central kind of thing here that people have to understand. And it's another one of those things that you have to work at because daily, from day to day, this is a balancing business, is that you have to establish some kind of balance between dependence and independence. And you can't go too much one way or the other, but both of those things really have to be there.
Absolutely. And, you know, you do see couples in different kinds of arrangements. You see couples that are in each other's pockets and totally involved with each other, and they both want it that way, and it works for them. You would say, oh, my God, I'd go nuts living with somebody breathing down my neck 24 hours a day. But you don't have to live with them. They're doing fine with each other. And you see other people who spend very little time together. They live parallel lives and get together from time to time very enjoyably, but really need a huge amount of space. And you can look at that and you say, well, that's not a marriage. That's two separate lives. But, again, it's not your marriage. So that for most of us, we try to find the balance between these two so that our whole sense of self doesn't come from the marriage and that we're not so busy pursuing our own self-interest that we don't take care of the marriage. So it is, what you said, a balancing business. Mm.
We have someone else to talk with here in Orland Park. That's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
It's a coincidence. Today is our 38th anniversary, so I guess I speak from a little experience.
A lot, yes.
And I'd say the first thing is you have to marry somebody who has the same lifetime commitment that you do, because people are not married 50 years and every year with hunky-dory. And nobody has to tell you how to handle the good times in your marriage. You can do that on your own. But two things I think that we do is, if we're having an argument, we stick to the topic. You don't talk about his mother or something parallel to that.
I think that
is so what you're arguing about.
Absolutely.
And that's not always easy to do.
No, and not always stick to the topic, but also stick to the time period instead of saying, well, and you also did this in 1974.
Right.
You also did this at our engagement party. You have to stick to the topic and stick to the present.
Right. And a long while ago, my husband headed up a large or a medium-sized company, and someone else the advice to pick your battles. And that's true. Think to yourself, is this worth arguing about? Because a lot of times it isn't. And if you keep your...
Hello?
Yeah.
Is the call... I'm sorry. You dropped out on us there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Pick your battles, and what did you say after that?
Think to yourself, is this really worth arguing about? And if it isn't, keep your mouth shut.
Well, I totally agree with the pick your battles thing, and what I would add to that is, you know, my husband and I will start having an argument, and one of us will say to the other, "Look, life is short. We're not getting divorced over this. We're going to make up. Why don't we just skip the whole argument and make up?"
Good idea.
All right. Well, thanks very much
for
the call.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate the comment. And again, other people you'd like to call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line. So that means if it would be long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think it is another thing that's that people, you know, I think have to understand is that there are going to be as much as you try to appreciate the fact that there is going to be this balance between dependence, independence, that there are going to be power struggles, and it seems that that's probably unavoidable. I recall my wife and I, we've been a couple now for 20 years, and when we first got our house and first started living together, we were fighting a lot until one day we realized that it was some sort of odd territorial battle that was going on. And it seemed that as soon as we came to that understanding, it stopped. That doesn't mean, you know, there aren't still power struggles, but
no. Consciousness helps. Becoming aware of what you're doing. It isn't the solution, but it's the beginning of the solution, because then you can, my husband and I have, I'm very territorial. So if we walk into any hotel room, I mean, I'll say, that's his dresser, that's my dresser, this is my side of the closet, that's your side of the closet. And my husband is an only child. He doesn't know what I'm talking about. I'm totally fair, but I'm always dividing.
Hmm.
And it took us a long time to understand that this was the only child versus, you know, the one with the sister issue. But he thought he could hang his clothes up anyway. I said, no, left side of the closet only.
There's a line here.
There's a line here, right.
Line. I guess that again points to another thing that people have to understand and kind of work with is the stuff that people bring with them from the rest of their life. And I guess the main place they'd be bringing that from would be the family that they grew up in, and whatever kind of struggles and battles and ways of doing things were part of that atmosphere, you can't help but bring that with you. And I'm not sure if knowing that about your partner helps, but it probably should, to know that they're going to be playing out some of these same routines that brothers and sisters.
Yeah, you know, people whose parents always solved arguments, you know, or argued screaming at the top of their lungs, married to someone who solved arguments or dealt with arguments by staring brutally out of a window, looking into the middle distance. And when somebody asks her, "What's the matter?" "Nothing, nothing at all. What makes you think anything is the matter?" These people are going to have a little difficulty with finding a fighting style that is civilized. I mean, I love what that last caller said about, you know, figuring out how to have arguments, not just sticking to the topic, but, you know, not to say things like, if you really love me, you do that, not go into a psychoanalytic description of their partner's reason for doing this, and not, you know, and not saying things that you can never, ever take back. I mean, there are a lot of ways of resolving these conflicts that can be very bruising, and a lot of ways that I would call much more grown up.
I think we're getting somebody else lined up here, and we'll get to them. And I guess I just want to make sure people listening, if you have questions, you have comments, you want to be part of the conversation, you can do that very easily by calling us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champaign, line one.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a bit off the topic, but hanging on my refrigerator door, and it has been for several years, is a little poem you wrote, written by your daughter to someone who had given her a gift. I wanted small pierced earrings gold. You gave me slippers gray. My mother said that she would scold unless I wrote to say how much I liked them. Not much.
Right.
I love that. And now when I Christmas or birthday shop for the grandkids, I look at that every time I leave the shop.
Well, that is in a children's book of mine, a collection of poems called If I Were in Charge of the World. And it's this whole issue, and it does apply to marriage in a way of, you know, how do you reconcile being totally honest with some degree of civility and consideration of your spouse?
Mm-hmm.
Not just the person you're writing the thank you note for, but, you know, I mean, do you really tell your husband exactly what you think of his mother or your true opinion of his green plaid sport jacket or, you know, last night's lovemaking? Were you going to say, well, it was 4.5, you know, maybe 4.6 on the scale? I mean, do you always have to say the absolute truth or are there ways of not volunteering that make life in a marriage and in general go a lot smoother?
Oh, of course. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, and I'm going to get your book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Bye. And again, certainly other folks who'd like to be involved in the conversation can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think, again, that people sort of have to think about, make the adjustment to maybe, is the move from early phase sex to married sex. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything wrong with married sex, but that, and there are some people for whom their sexual relationship is just not that important. But I think that there are a lot of people who would say, you know, I remember what it was like in the beginning when it seemed so powerful and so consuming, and, you know, you can make love with your partner, and it was, and there was nothing else in the world, in the universe. That was it, that moment, you can't maintain that forever. You maybe get back to it now and again,
You can get back to it now and then. Mm. And you can also find, as I heard from a lot of people, surprisingly, that everyday, ordinary married sex is as good as it gets, because in exchange for the newness and surprise and wonder of, you know, early lovemaking with your partner, is a level of comfort and ease and trust. I'm looking at a quote from a woman who says, even though there isn't the newness and the discovery and the frequency that we had at the beginning, what my husband and I have instead is more freedom and more honesty.
Hmm.
And another woman saying, routine, yes, it's routine, but routine has a safe, reassuring, and very comfortable side. And then the very unromantic man who said one might consider a sex life routine, but it's very enjoyable. Who tires of hitting a good golf shot?
What a guy response!
How would you like that on your Valentine?
I'm not the most romantic guy in the world, maybe, but no, I don't think that would be the right thing. I don't know, man, unless your wife was a was big golfer. I don't know. There might be the woman that would just work with.
I haven't found one yet. But what all these people are searching for is a reconciliation between routine sex that they are very familiar with, sex that is not the new, fresh sex of sexual life of the early days, they're trying to reconcile that with the fact that in a lot of ways it's better for them because of the ease and trust and comfort that, you know, they can say, you know, I want this or I don't want that, or let's try this, without feeling, ooh, what's she going to think of me? Ooh, what's he going to think of me? But feeling safe enough to express your deep down needs. And I would think that would be kind of hard in early new sex. You know, you go outside the marriage and you might get, you know, the thrill of something you've never had before. But the trust and the safety and the openness, I think, would be hard to come by.
Well, I do somehow think that the key to successful sexual relationship, a large part of it is the ability to make yourself vulnerable. And if you don't feel safe and secure in the situation, you're not going to do that.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it might also be nice if you get past that point when you think you got something to prove.
You bet. You bet. Where this is not a contest or something you're going to put on your resume.
I also think, when you look at the popular culture, it seems, first of all, that we're preoccupied with it, and that for longtime couples, there is a lot of this stuff about, you know, how to make it exciting again. And I don't know if that, what exactly that says, if, in fact, there are a lot of people who are having problems, or how many of them, you know, maybe their sex life is not like what it was, but that's okay with them, and they don't need all this stuff about how,
yeah,
you know, whether somebody's feeding us a line that's telling us that we should be doing something or it should be this way when it's not, and maybe that's not necessarily a problem.
Yeah, I mean, well, there is certainly so much sex-drenched programming and advertising in our culture today that, you know, you're made to feel that if you, you know, aren't lascivious at all times, you know, there must be something wrong with you. And I think people really need to get comfortable with the fact that if a man and a woman have agreed on what is good between the two of them, that's it. They don't have to measure up to anyone else's standards of frequency or variety or anything else. The only problem I see that is a legitimate problem in a couple's sex life is when they have two very, very different ideas about what and how much.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've got something they have to work out. But if two people are happy with the way they are in bed together, it's nobody else's business, and they don't have to worry about what Sex in the City is telling them they're missing.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with best-selling author Judith Viorst. She's written prose, poetry. She's the author of 16 children's books, and also this recent book that we're talking about here. It's titled Grown-Up Marriage. The subtitle says a lot. It's What We Know, Wish We Had Known, and Still Need to Know About Being Married. It's now out in paperback. It's published by Free Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the really powerful ideas in here that people need to know and need to continue to keep in mind about marriage if they really are determined that it's something that's going to last for a long time is that there will be times when, as much as you have been in love with your partner, you might one day say, you know, today, this week, this, you know, whatever period of time, I do not love this person, and that you've got to understand that, and you've got to be willing to try and find some way to ride that through, because chances are that'll turn around.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's what marriage can do for you. It can keep you together. It can hold you in place during these periods of time when you feel you're not in love with each other, or one person falls out of love with the other, or, you know, as more than one woman and a few men described to me, you wake up in the middle of the night thinking, in effect, who is this person? What am I doing here? You know, just absolutely appalled at what you've gotten into. And there are also times when it's not just falling out of love, where people really feel hatred for each other. Because who are you going to feel hatred for more than the person who you are so dependent upon, so involved with, who knows exactly what buttons to push and sometimes pushes them even though he or she shouldn't. So that there is a lot of intense emotion or that is very negative. There is a lot of disconnection that can horrify people, scare them, make them think, my Lord, I'd better get out of this because, you know, I'm not feeling good feelings anymore. And people really need to know that in most marriages, there are times when all the connections are broken and you feel anger, you feel unloving, you even feel hate.
Well, I think that's a really, really positive, powerful idea that people need to hang on to and understand, that idea that the kind of relationships we're talking about are relationships where there's a lot of powerful emotion, and you shouldn't, you know, it's not right to expect that all of those powerful emotions are going to be powerful, positive emotions.
Right, right.
Okay. Let's talk with some others. I think Champagne next, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hi, Judith Doss, it's a real honor, pleasure to have you online with us here. I've enjoyed your poetry for years.
Oh, thank you so much.
You get us through a lot of those hard spots that you're talking about, because I think while we're having a very somber discussion this morning, one of the main elements that one needs to have in a marriage is a sense of humor.
Can't survive without it.
A sense of humor about yourself as well as about the other guy. I emphasize guy. And sometimes I've been angry, as normal, and I've said something like, you treat your secretaries better than you do me. I'd like you to comment on that kind of difference that one has in relationships, if you get what I'm saying.
Hello?
Go ahead.
I heard a funny beep. I think this is a very big issue of just treating other people with more courtesy and consideration than they treat their own husband or wife. I mean, I find it amazing but very, very common that people feel, well, this is the place where I can let it all hang out and be my true, lovingly and considerate self. I mean, I have a story about a woman in my book who talked about treating his secretary better. Her husband comes home at night. He walks in the door. She's standing there. He doesn't even say hello. He sort of shuffles over to the table and goes through the mail. And she has tried, you treat my your secretary better. She has tried screaming. She has tried crying. She's now working on humor. She says, back, out the door, let's try this again, go out the door, close it, come in, and try hello. So she's trying to retrain him in this kind of behavior with humor, and it's working a little bit.
Let's go to another caller here. We have somebody on cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi, I called earlier. I didn't realize I was talking to Judith Voss. I want to tell you that one of the reasons my marriage lasted 34 years, or has lasted 34 years, is maybe 30 years ago I read one of your first books, and I remember a passage that said something to the effect, before I got married, I made sure that we had the same political views and social positions, but I had no idea that a person could feel so passionate about whether you should put the top back on a tube of toothpaste.
And exactly.
That, I just want to thank you for that book. And that was a long, long time ago.
I know, and we're still feeling passionate about the toothpaste around here, but we're laughing about it a little more.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for calling. Well, that really does point out the fact that sometimes the things that can be the most vexing are the tiniest things. The things you would think just don't matter. But
too dumb to care about.
Yes. But the fact is, no. Things can loom large.
He makes another point here, which is that when you discover that other people have the same experience, and you know, the book is full of people's experiences, and you say, it's not just me, it's not just ridiculous me. And if he can get through it, if she can get through it, if we can laugh about it or work it out, it's possible that this marriage can go on. And I'm not the only person in the world who's dumb enough to worry about which way the toilet roll unfolds or what you do with the toothpaste. There's something comforting about knowing that we're all in this together, struggling to work it out and solve it and make it better.
You know, I have known people who have felt that the hallmark of a great relationship was that you knew what the other person needed without them telling you. And you know, as if the best husband, I'll speak from the guy perspective, as if the best husband was somehow psychic,
could read his wife's mind.
And I think that that's a really tough burden to put on another person. But again, it suggests that part of the deal here is you've got to find a way, and there are good ways and there are bad ways, of communicating to your partner what it is you want from them, what your expectations are, and you cannot expect they're going to be able to read your mind.
Absolutely. No, I so totally agree with you. I mean, I announced to my husband 1 year, you probably think I'm much too sophisticated and cool to care about such commercial holidays as Mother's Day, and I'm not. I want flowers. I want attention. And I didn't wait for, you know, if I was going to wait around for him to figure this out by himself, you know, I could have a long, grumpy wait. So nobody ever has to wonder what my wishes and needs are. I make them very clear, and I think it would be very helpful if couples gave up the idea that they had married a mind reader.
Yeah. We have been talking about the joys and difficulties, the challenges, rewards of being in these really long relationships, and I don't want to have people think we're really all stressing all the negative stuff and the difficulty, even though there are negatives and can be difficult. I think we believe in it.
I've been married 44 years, and I feel as if I am the luckiest woman in the world. I've worked hard, and I've had a lot of dumb luck. But I feel that there is no better arrangement going and no better person to be in the arrangement with than my husband.
So having said all that, and I guess one does have to acknowledge the fact that for some people at some points, there really is no alternative but for them to get divorced.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm of the school. I mean, somebody said, you go to a marriage counselor and you work at it till your knuckles bleed. But if that doesn't do it, if you've done everything you possibly can and you cannot stay married, it is a perfectly honorable option to leave. But I think you have to be able to look back on a marriage and that you've left and say to yourself, I did everything I could.
That's, I guess, a difficult thing. And how do you – I think sometimes people give up too easily. But then again, how do you know when you've come to that point where you have done everything that you could?
Well, the marriage counselors tell me that they think a lot more marriages could be saved if people really put in the work that's necessary. And probably with marriage counseling, you would get some guidance and a little push in the direction of growing up in your marriage and working it out in your marriage. How you figure it out on your own, well, I guess, again, the more grown up you are, the more honest you are with yourself about whether you've put in the time and heart and caring and still failed.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, I think that sometimes people lament and go on about the very high rate of divorce in this country, and the number of marriages that end in divorce.
46%.
It's big.
At the moment, yeah.
But the thing I think that is really interesting is the rate of remarriage, that people, yes, there are a lot of the marriages that end in divorce, but there are a lot of people who are willing to try, and more than once.
Absolutely.
Which says something to me about really how – that says something – that it says as much about how we feel about marriage, I think, maybe more than the divorce rate, the rate of people who keep trying.
Yeah, I mean, even if, as the joke goes, remarriage is the triumph of hope over experience, the fact is people do hope that they're going to make a connection with somebody who they can walk through life with as a companion, and that when it works, it's the best thing going.
Mm. Do you think that there are particular, I don't mean to suggest you're old or anything, but do you think a particular challenge is involved in being married as couples age? And I'm really talking about, you know, not the young old, but I guess, the old.
Yeah, no, I have a whole chapter on growing older and old together. And certainly there are a lot of issues that come up with as people get sick, people retire, the whole retirement, what retirement does to a marriage can be very complicated. But balancing that is something that I encountered again and again with older married people. They feel so grateful. They have acquired the gift of gratitude, grateful for what they have together, grateful that they are still with each other, grateful for the wider life that they've been able to have because of each other. Over and over again, you hear these people saying, you know, I love it when I hear the car door open and I know he's home. This is the finest, most wonderful person I've ever been with in my life. People pausing, maybe because they've had time and gone through a lot together, people pausing to tip their hat with thanks that the marriage has endured and that it has given them so much. And that even though there's a lot of issues with health and retirement and people feeling diminished by age, perhaps in this way or that way, this is balanced by the gratitude.
Well, we will have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time, and I just want to say thank you very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it so much.
Our guest, Judith Viorst. You want to read the book? It's titled Grown Up Marriage, What We Know, Wish We Had Known, and Still Need to Know About Being Married. And it's now out in paper. It's published by the Free Press. You might also look at some of her other books, Suddenly 60, Forever 50, Necessary Losses. She's also the author of a number of children's books, including the classic, In Its Own Time, Alexander, and The Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day.